How do you tell the story of the men who've occupied the office of President of the United States? How do you tell the story so far? The story is in part, but inescapably, the story of a nation. The great mystery of any presidency is how these sovereign people of the United States will elect a leader. And then and only then, in the day by day, do they really begin to find out who that person is. History routinely has a way of throwing unexpected duties at a nation and the leaders who govern that nation. History reveals this. It throws you what it throws you, and you never know what's coming. It is in these unexpected fires that the character of the commander-in-chief is revealed. The historian Bernard DeVoto once wrote that when America was created, the stars must have danced in the sky. I agree. I think the great miracle of our nation is the hope that drives it and the character that is defined by our great optimism. For over 200 years, the men who have occupied the office of President of the United States have determinedly steered our nation towards safety in the hopes that we could give the people of our nation the same opportunities and freedoms that our forefathers had and protect those opportunities and freedom for those yet to come. A congressman or a senator can be wrong for 20 years and it never be of any consequence to a nation. Yet a president always casts the deciding vote. The men who have entered the room to the tune of Hail to the Chief have met that responsibility boldly and very well. These men have guided warriors at Bunker Hill, at Gettysburg, at Normandy, at Midway, and at the 38th parallel. They have guided an infant nation towards idealism, spared it from Nazism and fascism. They have stood in the gap as brother battled brother at Vicksburg. They have restored the confidence and hope of a nation after December 7th, the attacks at Pearl Harbor. They have begun the comforting and healing of a nation after terrorist attacks at Oklahoma City, New York City, and the Pentagon. What did these men do? Who did they become? And how did they forge the destiny of a nation? These are the questions we will ask as we effort to understand some success lessons from U.S. presidents. It is my firm belief that if we can extract success lessons from these great men and apply these lessons to our lives, perhaps we can catapult the success of our life to parallel the success of a great nation. Now, this is not a partisan talk. We will be getting success lessons from Democrats and Republicans, and one president whose party was known as the Democratic Republicans. That president whose party was known as the Democratic Republicans was our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a genius. Thomas Jefferson had an intellect unparalleled among modern presidents and among almost any presidents. When historians do polls and they ask who is the most intelligent president of all time, Thomas Jefferson is routinely at the top of that poll. The year was 1962, and John F. Kennedy was hosting a dinner at the White House for Nobel Prize winners. He stood up before the dinner began, and he made a speech. And in that speech, he said, "You know, I'm looking at these Nobel Prize winners, and I think that this is possibly the greatest collection of human talent and knowledge in the history of the White House." With, of course, the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined here alone. Bill Clinton, during his presidency, he also hosted a dinner for Nobel Prize winners, and he made the same statement. He stood before them and said, "This is the greatest collection of human talent and knowledge in the history of the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined here alone." John Adams, who was our second president, and it was kind of interesting back then, the president and the vice president didn't have to run on the same ticket. They didn't have to be members of the same party. And this was the case in this scenario. John Adams was a Federalist, and Thomas Jefferson belonged to a party called the Democratic Republicans. They were somewhat political foes, but one was president and the other was vice president. John Adams once said that one cannot come away from a one-hour meeting with Thomas Jefferson and not come away with something marvelous. Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence. He was the governor of Virginia during the Revolutionary War. He was the Secretary of State for President Washington during his first term. Jefferson also was into architecture. He designed and built Monticello, which is an estate in Virginia that he lived in and still stands today. He was involved in agriculture, linguistics, music, philosophy, and prose. You may think to yourself, wow, this man was a great thinker. He must have seen himself as a king or an aristocrat. He must have seen himself above everyone else. No, he did not see himself that way. What others dabbled in, Jefferson mastered. Yet that is not how he saw himself. He saw himself as a common man. And that is one of the lessons that we're going to take from the life of Thomas Jefferson. A great story to illustrate how he saw himself as a common man is this. Andrew Marry was the British minister to the United States, and he paid a visit to the White House and specifically to Thomas Jefferson. During this visit to the White House, Thomas Jefferson just happened to be in pajamas and slippers. Well, Andrew Marry arrived at the White House, and this is how Jefferson was already dressed. Jefferson saw himself as a common man, but he saw everybody else as common men. In other words, he saw everybody as equal. He didn't see one person more special than another. So when Andrew Marry, the minister from England, walked in, Jefferson, the president of the United States, greeted this ambassador, greeted this minister in his pajamas. You see, it was Thomas Jefferson's way of saying, I am not a Federalist, because the Federalist were the aristocrats. They were the kings, and it was George Washington, and it was John Adams, and they believed that the American society needed to be governed by the elite, that the American society needed to be governed by the well-educated, the well-connected, the socially connected, or the wealthy. Thomas Jefferson said, no, it doesn't. The United States of America needs to be governed by the common man, by every man. And guess what, elite? Guess what, Federalist? As elite as you think you are, you yourselves are also common men. We all are. Well, that minister from Britain, Andrew Marry, he was insulted. He went back and told everybody how insulted he was, because he was high and mighty, and he did not want to be insulted by being greeted in his pajamas. Thomas Jefferson believed that even though he was the president of the United States, he was simply one voter in our democracy. Not since Thomas Jefferson. No political party has ever claimed to be the party of the elite. Since Thomas Jefferson, no political party has claimed to be the party of the aristocrats. No politician, no man, no woman has stood up on a platform and said, I'm the party of the well-educated. I'm the party of the elite. I'm the party of the sophisticated and the party of the well-connected. No politician or party has said that since Thomas Jefferson, because Jefferson set a standard. And if that standard was violated today by someone with that pompous behavior, they would be defeated in an instant, because we are a Jeffersonian democracy, and a Jeffersonian democracy says that it can be ruled by the common man. When Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence, he wrote in there, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What did Thomas Jefferson say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. What is the life lesson that we can extract from the life of Thomas Jefferson? It is this. If you are down in the dumps, if you feel discouraged because you do not feel you are among the well-educated, the elite, the socially well-connected, and you may be thinking to yourself, what kind of impact can I have on history, and what kind of impact can I have on the world? What kind of impact can I have on my own life when I don't have a lot of money, or I'm not socially well-connected, or I'm not well-educated? To that, Thomas Jefferson would say hogwash. His idea or his goal would be to bring out the Jefferson in you. Jefferson's goal was to bring out the Jefferson in every man. And that is the realization that we are all the common man. And even the president of the United States is just one more voter. And we can all have an impact. And that is the legacy of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. The next president that we're going to look at his life is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. If you grew up during the Roosevelt presidency, it seemed that he might have been president forever. He was president from 1933 to 1945. He was president for 12 years, just a little bit over 4 terms. He is the only president that that's ever happened to. Since then, there's been an amendment that says you can only serve as two terms as president of the United States. The Chief Justice does the swearing-in ceremony at the inaugurations for each president. The Chief Justice for Franklin Delano Roosevelt was Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes. Charles Evans Hughes went to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and as they were rehearsing for the swearing-in ceremony at the inauguration, he quipped to FDR, and he said, "Mr. President, don't you think this is getting a little bit monotonous for everybody?" In other words, FDR was the only president been elected to three, nonetheless, four terms. It was pretty remarkable, and it hasn't happened since, and it won't happen because of the amendment. In 1921, FDR was stricken with polio. And this polio put him in a wheelchair. He was in paralysis for the rest of his life. But it did not stop him from accomplishing great things. He was the governor of New York from 1929 to 1933. Right when the Depression was striking, he was governor of New York. And he steered that state and later steered our country through the Great Depression. His philosophy on the Great Depression was do something, do anything, and if that doesn't work, try something else. He was an incredible leader. His leadership was tested on December 7th, 1941. On that fateful day, the Empire of Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. In his quote that will live forever, FDR said, "This is a date which will live in infamy." He took a nation and restored its hope and restored its confidence. And he did that through fireside chats as we entered into World War II. FDR knew the importance of communicating with the followers. And in his case, the followers were the members of the United States, were the citizens of the United States. Einstein was the leader, and he knew two important things that every leader should learn. And this is the lesson we're going to extract from his life. The first lesson that FDR learned is that as a leader, sometimes goals take a long time. In the case of World War II, it went from 1941 to 1945. That is a long time. To have people dying and to be in the midst of a war. The goal, though, was to defeat Nazism and fascism and defeat the Empire of Japan and restore freedom and democracy to countries that had been captive by dictatorships. That was the mission. And so as that was the mission, FDR had these fireside chats, which were weekly or regularly scheduled radio addresses. And during these fireside chats, number one, he did what every leader needs to do. He reminded the country of our ultimate goal. This is our ultimate goal. This is where we are going. This is where we are. And then he would, number two, after he reminded them of the goal, he would constantly update them. "Guys, these are the battles we're winning. This is our status report. This is what we're doing." You see, if you are a leader in your business or in your life, take these two lessons from FDR. The first lesson is constantly communicate with your followers. Remind them of the end goal. Tell them what the goal is, because if you don't, they're going to get discouraged. They may get sidetracked and they'll end off over here doing something else. After you've reminded them of the end goal, do what FDR did and give them progress reports. "Okay, guys, this is what we did good. This is what we need to do better. And here's the updates on that." FDR was a master at that. He was a master at communicating. He was a master at leadership and almost lived to see the end of World War II. He didn't, though. He one day, near the end of World War II, he said, "I have a terrible headache." He retired to his room, laid down, and he was dead a few hours later. But let's not forget the lessons of FDR. If you're a leader, communicate with those who are following you. Remind them of the end goal and give them updates and progress reports. He was succeeded by his vice president, who is Harry Truman. Harry Truman is by far one of my favorite presidents. I love the life of Harry Truman. And one of the reasons I like the life of Harry Truman so much is this guy was just a straight shooter. He was a square talker and he was just an ordinary guy. Maybe somebody you might want to watch a football or a baseball game with. Harry Truman, his middle initial was S. You may have heard him referred to as Harry S. Truman. Guess what? The S didn't stand for anything. It was just simply that. It was simply an initial. Whenever he became president and he heard about FDR's death, he said to the men around him who were members of the government, he said, "Men, if you've ever prayed, you better pray for me now." He was a humble man, but he also understood the task that was up upon his shoulders. He understood the mantle that had been placed on his shoulders. And you know what? Harry Truman never had a college degree, but he was the president of the United States. At the age of 33, he joined the Army, and he became captain of the artillery. After the Army, he went back to Kansas, and in Kansas, he started a men's clothing store. The men's clothing store went bust, and so he decided that he was going to get involved in politics, and he became a United States senator. This is when he caught the eye of FDR. Later, FDR asked him to be his vice president. His presidency had some remarkable, memorable moments. Harry Truman was the man, the commander-in-chief, who made the call to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ultimately sped up the end of World War II. He said it was the hardest decision of his life and one that he agonized over for some time. During his presidency, there was an assassination attempt, and two men attacked the house that he was staying at. He was staying at the Blair House. The White House was undergoing renovations, so he went to the Blair House, which is right next to the White House. And when he was at the Blair House, these men took a taxi to the Blair House. They get out, and they start shooting the guards, because they're going to shoot the guards and make their way to the president. Well, the president, Harry Truman, was asleep, and whenever he was asleep, he woke up, he walked to the window and looked outside to see what the gunshots were all about. Now, fortunately, the thugs didn't look up and shoot him and assassinate him. Harry Truman obviously wasn't thinking, and despite his attempts to cooperate with the assassins, it didn't work. Harry Truman left office without running for re-election. And the reason that he did not run for re-election was his approval rating was so incredibly low that he knew he could not get re-elected. Why was his approval rating low? Well, because the people of the United States did not understand something called the Truman Doctrine. But historians do. So while, although his approval rating was so low and he couldn't get reelected and he stepped down, historians looking back regard Harry Truman as a great president. Why do they regard him as a great president? As I mentioned, the Truman Doctrine. Now you may say, well, what is the Truman Doctrine? I'll share with you what it is, and it's also the lesson that we are going to glean from the presidency of Harry Truman. The Truman Doctrine says this. It says the United States cannot be isolationist. In other words, we can't just sit and let the world what happens and not worry about anything but ourselves. We can't do that. The Truman Doctrine says the United States cannot be isolationist. We must be internationalist. This contradicted the Monroe Doctrine. James Monroe was our fifth president. And he said, we can be isolationist. And as long as it's not happening right around us, we're not going to worry about it. Truman realized that this couldn't be a feasible option. And he shifted us from being isolationist to internationalist. Now, what does this mean in simple layman's terms? Let me give you an example, a true example. 1947, Greece and Turkey, war is breaking out there. Harry Truman says, I know we're in the United States. I know war is breaking out in Greece and Turkey, but we have to intervene, guys. We have to get involved in this. The member of the United States government said, why do we have to get involved in it? It's in Greece and Turkey. It has nothing to do with us. Harry Truman began the Truman Doctrine right then and there. He said, you are so incredibly wrong. He said, the Soviet Union, communism is over on the other side of the globe. And if we do not intervene in Greece and Turkey, communism is going to spread to those countries. Greece will become a communist country. Turkey will become a communist country. And then before you know it, it's going to be a domino effect, and it's going to spread over Europe. And then all those countries will become communist. And then the countries in Asia will become communist. And then you know what? The world is going to be communist, and the United States cannot survive in a world that is totally against it. Harry S. Truman invested $400 million in Greece and Turkey. He had a great quote, and it really sums up the Truman Doctrine. The Truman Doctrine says this, we are guardians of a great faith. We believe that freedom offers the best opportunity for peace and prosperity. We cannot separate our desires for peace from our belief in liberty. It is our hope that in the years ahead, other nations will come to know freedom and liberty. Do you understand what he was saying with the Truman Doctrine? He was saying we are guardians of a great faith, and that faith is freedom and liberty and prosperity and peace. For us to maintain that, those things have to be going on around the world, because if freedom and liberty and peace are not going around around the world, whether we believe it or not, eventually that will affect us. Guess what? Rarely does a democracy attack another democracy. So it was in our interest to spread democracy. Since that time, we have intervened in Lebanon and Libya. Right after World War II, the United States got involved in something called the Marshall Plan, which is a direct result from the Truman Doctrine. In the Marshall Plan, we rebuilt Italy and France and England because we wanted them to be strong. We knew if they were strong and democracy was prospering, it made us a safer nation. We have gotten involved in Grenada, in Haiti, in Nicaragua, and fought in Panama because of the Truman Doctrine. If you think that it does not matter who you surround yourself with, if here's the lesson you should glean for your life. If you think that in your life you can be an isolationist and it has no effect on your life, I got news for you, folks. Just as the United States have to be not isolationist but internationalist, according to the Truman Doctrine at least, just as that's true, you can't live your life as an isolationist. And what I mean by this, you may say, well, it doesn't matter who I hang out with. It doesn't matter who my friends are. It doesn't matter who surrounds me. As long as I know who I am and I'm fine with myself, I can surround myself with anybody that I want. It doesn't matter. Harry Truman says hogwash. They may not be right next to you. They may be your extended neighbors, but as long as they are around you, eventually they will affect you. That is the Truman Doctrine, and that's what I want you to take and apply to your life. The people you surround yourself with will affect you. The year was 1985, and there was a dinner in Washington. It was well-known political analyst George Will and Bob Novak, and they were having dinner with President Ronald Reagan. And this comes our last lesson from success lessons from U.S. presidents. As they were having dinner in 1985 with President Reagan, Reagan said, you know, I wish I could get in a helicopter and I could fly over the United States with Mikhail Gorbachev. I wish we could stop in people's homes and Gorbachev could see that we have cars in every driveway. We have boats in the driveway. He could see how the people lived in clean homes and they lived in nice homes. If Gorbachev could see this, Ronald Reagan said, I believe he might change his ways and the Soviet Union may crumble, or at least the communism will crumble and capitalism and democracy will spread across the Soviet Union. You see, Ronald Reagan at that dinner in 1985, he was an optimist. He was an optimist. But George Will and Bob Novak, whenever he said it, looked at each other and kind of smirked. And I thought, well, this is just another case of the naive, out-of-touch president not being in touch with reality. How wrong they were. He was more in touch with reality than anyone else because he was an optimist. He knew born in the hearts of people, of all men, regardless of what country you're born in, whether it be the United States of America or the USSR, born in your heart is a desire to be free. Born in your heart is a desire to build and grow. Reagan was an optimist and he knew this. And he had to be an optimist. He took over the country at a time when it was not an optimistic nation. It was at the end of the decade of the 1970s. The United States had a cloud of Watergate hanging over the White House. It had a cloud of Vietnam hanging over the White House. The economy was so bad in the years prior to Reagan becoming president that economists came up with something called the misery index. That's how bad our economy was. And the misery index told us in number figures how bad the economy was. And then all of a sudden, the 40th president of the United States walks on the scene with optimism. And this is the lesson I want you to draw from the life of Ronald Reagan. You may be in the middle of horrible circumstances, as Reagan could have potentially been. But he came to the table and he came to the office of President of the United States believing that communism could fall, believing in America, because he was an optimist. It's almost an insult to say that the legacy of Reagan is that he was an optimist, because every sixth person watching this program perhaps is an optimist. If you don't do something about it, though, that's where Reagan made the difference. It means nothing. Ronald Reagan stood at the Brandenburg Gate in Germany at the Berlin Wall, and he said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. You see, that was not written into Reagan's speech. He wrote it in there. His speech speechmakers crossed it out. He put it back in. His speechmakers crossed it out. He put it back in. His speechmakers crossed it back out. And finally, he said, fine, don't put it in. I'm still going to say it. Because, see, his speechmakers weren't an optimist. He thought there was no way Gorbachev would tear down that wall. Ronald Reagan was an optimist. And at the Brandenburg Gate, he said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Months after his presidency, Gorbachev did exactly that. Would he have done that if Reagan wasn't an optimist and hadn't made that challenge? Reagan made us proud to be Americans again. When the flag went by, we all stood a little bit taller. He reminded us of the mission of freedom. He had a quote where he used to say, it's morning in America. And what he was saying is, morning is a time of optimism. The dark days are behind us. It is morning in America. He kindled the hope of America once again with his optimism. And that is the lesson of President Ronald Reagan. When others worried, he persevered. When others weakened, he stood tall. When others stepped back, he stood forward. Why? Optimism. The glass of Ronald Reagan was always half full. He was an optimist. And because his glass was half full, communism fell. Because Reagan was an optimist and his glass was half full, the economy prospered. Because Reagan's glass was half full and he was an optimist, the hostages in Iran were released on the day of his inauguration. The lesson that you extract from Ronald Reagan is this: regardless of your circumstances, if you've gone through your own personal Watergate, if your own economic situation perhaps could use a misery index, maintain optimism. Magical things will happen when you are an optimist. The last note from Ronald Reagan is this: on his desk, he had a plaque, and I have taken a plaque and made this same one and put on my desk. The quote was this: it can be done. He put that on his desk. I've taken a very similar plaque and put that on my desk. What was he referring to? It can be done. Everything. Because he's an optimist. Communism will fall. The economy will prosper. The hostages will get released. That is the lesson that you take from the life of our 40th president, Ronald Reagan. The lesson that you take from Harry Truman is that you cannot survive a positive life if you have negative people around you. It's important who you surround yourself with. The lesson that you're going to take from FDR is this: if you are a leader, you must constantly remind those who are following you of the end goal. You must constantly remind them and give them updates and status reports, because if you don't, they're going to get discouraged. They're going to get depressed. They will wander away, and you will never accomplish your goal. The lesson that we're going to take from our third president, Thomas Jefferson, the Democratic Republican, the great genius, is that all men are created equal. We are all endowed with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Remember, Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States, yet he viewed himself simply as another voter. He viewed himself as a common man. He believed I could make a difference, and he believed you could make a difference. If you don't believe you could make a difference right now, bring out the Jefferson in you. Find the Jefferson that lurks deeply inside you with the optimism of Reagan, with the leadership of FDR, and with the wisdom of Harry S. Truman. How do you tell the story of a presidency? How do you tell the story so far? I think you look at their lives. I think you extract what you can. And I think you learn some lessons from these great men. I hope you have. I know I have.